Thank you. May it please the court. During the pendency of this appeal, the government filed a motion to dismiss, challenging this court's jurisdiction. That motion was deferred in order to be incorporated into the arguments today in the brief submitted to the court. And I think it's best that I start at that point on the theory that this court doesn't have any jurisdiction. I don't know what any of us are doing here at this moment. This case involved a guilty plea on a sentencing. There was a memorandum submitted to the court.
I understand. You're saying that Judge Clever committed legal errors in his analysis and so on. But I don't see, maybe the discussion is not satisfactory, but I don't see how you can get to first base in a case like this. I mean, she's an anesthesiologist. She's fighting for the retention of her license. She engages in elaborate fraud. How could she be thought mentally incompetent?
Not mentally incompetent.
I think that's the disbelief that sort of informs Judge Clever's analysis, even if it's not very clear.
Well, I would advise the court that the brief points out the issue of her mental stability first came up during a bond hearing after her guilty plea, where the judge himself asked her that she submit to a psychiatric examination. She did that, and a report was returned to the court upon which the court acted. The court accepted that report and acted on that report. Subsequently, that report was part of the documentation reviewed and used in submitting a final report to the court as far as our request for downward departure under 5K213, diminished capacity, which is different from incompetent. We never said she was incompetent.
She doesn't understand money.
She's terrible at understanding money.
And I know what I mean. I think I'm
well, more good at it than you are.
I think after that judicial notice, the judge has got to be bad with money or he wouldn't have taken this job.
Well, I'm a federal defendant, so I don't know where that fits into the scheme of things.
But I've been working for 12 months for free, so that's good.
But think of the fun we're having. Our feeling is that when the district court accepted the memorandum, accepted the testimony, listened to the testimony, began questioning the psychologist who was qualified, we feel, and then rejected his testimony, he did so under the cover of Daubert. And
what,
doing that...
Could you explain to me what difference any of this makes today? After the PROTECT Act, the question whether to depart downward is made de novo by the Court of Appeals.
I understand that.
So whether the district court was right or wrong or made a mistake or didn't make a mistake seems to me, under the current statutory arrangement, 100% irrelevant. The question that you ought to be arguing is whether we should order a departure from the guidelines. Because what the district court did under the PROTECT Act, no matter what it did, we will throw in the trash and do it again. That's what the statute says. So here we are.
All right.
Why don't you just make the argument that we should do it?
Well, I can take you up literally on that or answer rhetorically. Literally, I think that the record speaks for itself. Rhetorically, I think it's important that courts be advised that appellate tribunals do look at matters that are inconsistent, do look at matters that in which standards are misapplied, do look in which testimony is summarily rejected without notice, without objection from the government, and at least...
Maybe you don't really want to make an argument that we should do it.
Oh, yes, I do.
You're not giving me a reason why I should say this person is entitled to a departure.
All right, I'll give you that. The reason for that is contained both in the reports submitted to the court and in the testimony provided by the doctor that testified at the sentencing hearing. He testifies that our client was suffering from 3 recognized mental and emotional disabilities. Among those, a dependent personality, among those...
And why is any of those a good ground for a departure? Basically, everybody who commits a crime is disturbed in some way. And I assume white-collar people who commit crimes, like your client, are especially disturbed because they can't say, I'm doing this because I have no legitimate legal alternatives. Right. For a white-collar defendant to commit a crime implies that there's a mental problem. But it's not the case that every white-collar defendant gets a departure from the guidelines. That would make no sense whatsoever.
No, but when you look at this client's diminished... First of all, there is a statutory recognition that if you have a diminished capacity, you're entitled to move for downward departure. Acting on that, you then use the pool of people situated like hers, that is, other people involved in financial fraud, whether it be bank fraud or others.
But diminished capacity couldn't refer, say, to a third of the population, could it?
In my business, it applies to way more than that. But,
that's my point. You can't justify a departure for a huge fraction of the set of all criminal cases. The whole idea of departures is that they're supposed to be for the tiny tip on the distribution. And a line of argument that applies to a third of all criminal defendants, or maybe two-thirds of all white-collar criminal defendants, just can't work. Almost by definition, it can't work.
I agree with you completely. However, she has a combination of disabilities that does put her on that outside point, including adult attention deficit disorder, which seems to be totally inconsistent.
How can
that characterizes 50% of the lawyers we see.
How can an anesthesiologist have
some
a
of
serious
the
attention deficit problem and be permitted to? Because if her mind wanders, you know, while she's administering anesthesia, the patient will die.
Absolutely correct. Her narrow disability deals with financial affairs.
Well, now you're making things up.
No, it's in the
psychologist. But that's just too pat, right?
Well, somebody made it up, not you.
I don't know that it's too pat. Again, this is a process that was triggered by an inquiry by the judge.
Look, I mean, attention deficit syndrome, whatever it's called, this presumably is some defect in the brain, isn't it?
That
Why
I
would it be
about.
Compartmentalized to financial matters?
It has started to be developed during the course of the testimony and the report submitted. They're part of the record in this case. It is truly inconsistent with what I thought. When I had this doctor of psychology explaining to me that there was an attention deficit disorder possibility for somebody who had achieved a medical degree, I was taken aback. I mean, I don't like to look foolish in front of a court or anyone else. I found it inconsistent. But it did get my attention. I followed through on it. And I found out it does exist. And there are people like her that suffer under this all the time. They perform perfectly normal lives in what they are trained to do and can be trained. Some of the questions I asked, she took science courses. She took mathematical courses. She handled all these things as far as the college curriculum, as far as her medical training.
But not only that, she has practiced as an anesthesiologist.
Correct.
Think.
Yes, she has.
So she had to concentrate.
Right, correct. But when she was, but and that she can do, and apparently she can not only do it, but do it quite well.
How long did her business last before it went bankrupt?
Her business in various forms probably lasted about 5 or 6 years.
So she must have been concentrating during some of that time.
She was concentrating on the business and the medical treatment, healthcare providing end of it, but not on the economic part of it. The economic part of it, she hired a man who appears in the record, whose name is Rupicki, who hires himself out as a consultant. And he's the one that arranged a loan for her. She signed the loan. And so she, like many people in professions, turned their financial affairs over to the people who hold themselves out as knowing more than they do or having more time to do those things. It happens everything from athletes to lawyers. And often, the results are disastrous. We're changing lights on me pretty quick.
Yeah, that was a fast one. You forgot in the first one.
You want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, I would if I could. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Burke. Mr. Watzka?
May it please the Court. My name is Kelly Watzka. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I represent the United States in this matter. Your Honor, we did file a motion to dismiss this appeal because we believe there is a jurisdictional flaw in this matter.
How can there be a jurisdictional problem after the PROTECT Act, which you don't discuss?
You know, you're right, Your Honor. We didn't discuss the Protect Act.
We are now given the duty of making a de novo decision about the propriety of departure. We're no longer in the old world of limited review of district court departure decisions.
And
the Department of Justice sold this legislation to Congress and is going to have to live with it. Here we are.
All right. And with that in mind, Your Honor, I'll address the merits of the diminished capacity complaint filed by the defendant in this matter. The reason why this court should not place any merit or any importance on this defendant's claim of diminished capacity is precisely the reason why Judge Clevert denied it in the first instance. There was expert testimony presented. The judge used a perfectly reasonable measure of reliability by looking to the Daubert standard to ensure that the testimony bore some indicia of reliability, that it was relevant to the issue of whether this particular defendant was truly extraordinary, not simply whether or not she had been correctly diagnosed with various conditions or impairments or personality disorders. I would suggest to you that Judge Clifford's choice of words was perhaps poor. And there is language in the record which suggests that he felt compelled to reject Dr. Levin's testimony. But I think a fair reading of the record as a whole demonstrates that he did not reject Dr. Levin's diagnoses of Dr. Farron. He did not find that Dr. Levin was unqualified to make those diagnoses or offer expert opinion on those diagnoses. What he found was that the testimony was unreliable to sustain a claim for diminished capacity because it was speculative. Judge Clevert notes that a number of times in his testimony, Dr. Levin says, "I suggest" or "I suspect" such and such occurred. It was unsupported by anything other than his own personal experience in terms of how this doctor compared with other defendants who commit white-collar offenses. There was no basis upon which the court could find that she was outside the heartland of defendants. And the testimony itself supported such a finding. We'll concede the fact, I think Judge Clevert did, that this woman has problems. She doesn't have a particularly good sense of business judgment or otherwise. But Dr. Levin's own testimony demonstrates that she appreciates the difference between the truth and a lie. She appreciates right from wrong and what it means to steal. She wasn't suffering from any compulsive disorder that caused her to engage in her fraudulent activities. And that is the finding required by law in order for a defendant to be entitled to a departure for diminished capacity. And that simply wasn't present in this case. This is a woman who has extraordinary intelligence, and what the district court find, and I submit to you that it would be an appropriate finding for this court, is that the defendant did not meet its burden of establishing that her life was so compartmentalized, so divided, that she could be a perfectly professional and successful physician, and anesthesiologist at that, and yet have no ability to control or make decisions or write decisions about the business end. You know, this is a doctor who I suppose that, you know, if she truly had this inability to make business decisions, she belonged in a hospital, you know, not running her own business practice as she did for 5 years before she filed for bankruptcy.
Well, maybe she has math block.
You know what, Your Honor, maybe she does, but I would submit to the court that's not a sufficient basis. That's not a truly extraordinary problem that takes her outside the heartland. That doesn't mean that she didn't have the ability to control her conduct or appreciate that it was wrongful. She did. The record clearly establishes that.
How about an anti-materialistic syndrome? You have no interest in gathering property, and so you lose money. That sounds like a good one. It goes along with this one.
It may be. I don't find this defendant particularly sympathetic.
I'm not a jocular, so don't pay any attention to me.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Unless the court has further questions, mm-hmm. I'm really going to rest on our written submissions at this point.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wanska. Mr. Burke, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
I'm very tempted to pursue the issue of math block, but I'll defer. I am unaware precisely of the application of the PROTECT Act and the date that it went into effect, Your Honor, and I apologize for that. It was neither briefed nor raised as an issue by either party, and so I don't want you to think that I defer simply or waive that argument simply because I didn't respond. I don't have the information with me to do that. This is an interesting case if we ever get beyond the jurisdictional point, because throughout Dr. Levin's testimony, based on the way that the judge analyzed...
Well, but I don't know. Maybe but one of the things he said was kind of... that the judge said was kind of telling was that the psychologist hadn't really looked into her financial affairs and didn't really have any way of saying how unusual her condition was. Right, the judge kept asking him, you know, looked at the general population, you know, how many people have this.
But the general population isn't the issue in this
case. Well, no, it is in the sense that psychologists probably think we're all slightly nuts, right?
But and they're probably right.
Okay? But you can't have a situation which 280 million people have diminished capacity. So it's relevant for the judge to inquire, well, you've said she has this, she has that, the other. But is this really a rare condition, or a rare collection of conditions, or is this the sort of thing that millions of people, many millions of people have? They're good at their profession, but they're incompetent in their in new ventures or anything outside their basic training.
With all due respect to both yourself and the trial court, I think that what you're doing is performing the task that we wish that Judge Clifford had done, is by running that analysis of this and finding out whether or not there was a basis to depart.
No, but he asked the psychologist. That psychologist said no, he hadn't looked into the, you know, incidence of this in the population, and he hadn't looked at her financial dealings to see how complicated they were, her failure to, you know, her fraud was something that only a crazy person would commit.
We're not talking about crazy. We're not talking about incompetent. We're talking about diminished capacity, and there's a difference. And we're also talking about a highly trained psychologist whose testimony has been accepted regularly throughout this country, who didn't just casually go after this.
Well, he gave her a test. She's a sophisticated person. She knows how to flunk a psychiatric test, surely.
But she didn't. She didn't. There were certain flaws that showed up. But she didn't flunk a psychiatric test.
No, flunk. What I mean is, flunking a psychiatric test means you're given a test to show whether you're normal. Well, you have an advantage, of course, in showing that you're abnormal. And if you're sophisticated, you know which questions to answer which way to show that you have attention deficit disorder, you have anxiety, you're a substance abuser, and anything else you want to add.
But isn't that, and again, this is not my field, but aren't psychologists trained to head off those kind of answers during those tests?
I don't know.
But my understanding was that psychologists
I don't know why the judge should know. What, do you think psychologists are wizards at knowing when people are lying to them?
Well, psychologists think they will, they know, because they say that there's a possibility you were being programmed or that you're angry, and they'll say no.
Right.
Trial judges with psychologists because they can...
No, I'm not making those arguments.
The psychologist, you say, asks a person a question. He knows whether he's telling the truth.
No, they take those questions at face value.
They answer at face value. You can run 100 batteries. The point is, if you're a sophisticated person and you want a certain diagnosis, you know precisely how to answer which questions which way. If you're dumb, no, you can be tricked and give inconsistent answers. If you're smart, you can flunk.
But that same argument can be made about drug agents that come into court at sentencing and testify about the quantity of drugs. They know how to answer these questions, too. They're more highly trained than my client was. They are equally as trained and experienced in court as a psychologist. To summarily reject a professional's opinions and not consider them, particularly when it violates the rules that are set out in the law books that I think still have some meaning, is wrong. And it sets a very dangerous precedent in doing that.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. And you were appointed, were you not?
No, I was. Our office was appointed, yes, Your Honor.
We work for the Federal Defender Services.
Right, but it's pro bono.
It is.
Yes. Well, we thank you very much for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you.
And the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.